Hello and welcome to another episode of our Data Topics podcast. This is the second episode in the AI ethics series. Previous one, we discussed AI ethics in general, try to understand why it is so important, maybe also what ethics, what we mean by ethics in the AI ethics case, and think a bit about how this could be translated to reality. One major topic there was also the more regulatory side of things. And so the objective today is to dive a bit deeper into that topic. Around the table, we have once again, Tim. Hello.
Hi, I'm Tim, a machine learning engineer at DataRoots, but a background in research psychology, which means I have a particular interest in the human side of the problems we try to solve with AI. So I'm very interested to hear more about the regulatory aspect today.
Welcome.
Thanks.
Hi, Rob.
Hi, I'm Rob Heyman. I'm glad to be back as well. I'm the coordinator of the Knowledge Center Data and Society. My background is in social sciences, and my biggest challenge is translating AI and ethical requirements to a pragmatic level so that everyone can use it.
Thank you. Virginie?
Hi, I'm Virginie. I'm head of DataRoots research, so I'm in charge of all innovative projects within DataRoots, and of course, Law and the AI Act is on the radar for me.
And I'm Jan de Bruyne. I also work at the Knowledge Center for Data and Society, and I'm also working at the KU Leuven Center for IT and IP Law, where we focus on the regulation of AI and the many legal challenges that arise, and especially my expertise in the field of liability law.
Awesome. I mean, I think we'll have a lot of questions for you in this episode. Just a heads up. The recent weeks as well, there have been, like many other weeks, probably many new advances in AI regulation. There was, I think, the AI Bill of Rights two weeks ago, when we recorded the session. But is legislation the way to go, do we think? I mean, how far can legislation go in this aspect?
Well, of course, I'm a legal scholar, so we tend to love legislation. But I think legislation does not solve all problems. And we have the AI Act that has been proposed last year. It contains a risk-based approach, which is, I think, a good way to go. There are several challenges still, several problems with regard to notions, application, definitions, and so on. But it's clear that the EU will go the risk-based approach. That will be the future. So we have this general AI framework prohibiting certain AI systems, imposing requirements for high-risk AI systems. But in addition to that, of course, we do have other regimes that already apply. Consumer protection, GDPR, product safety, product liability. And in all these frameworks, there are problems, gaps, challenges, and these are increasingly being addressed now. And last week, we had the proposals of an AI liability regime, fault-based liability, and product liability, a revision of the product liability directive. So these things are really coming the next... It's not yet a law, of course. It will still go via the parliament and the council. And I think in 2 years or something, it will be adopted. But it's the way forward, that there will be a harmonized regime on liability.
Talking about, I mean, there's indeed a lot of things coming, as you mentioned, and especially also, you take the AI Act, it's for the moment, it's a proposal, and then it will take some time for it is applied, but that there's not yet any consequences if it's not 100% respected. And then there's a phase where the control mechanism actually starts to work, I think similar as we've seen with GDPR indeed. But I mean, actually, I have two questions related to that. I think back when we had GDPR, Europe was one of the front runners in terms of data privacy. And so what Europe defined was set the example in terms of a framework. So my first question maybe is now we see a lot of things moving in parallel. I think there's stuff moving in the United States on this side of the channel. Even in China, I've seen that they've been editing some things to govern this space. Isn't this a risk that we will have kind of different perspectives of the same that is maybe difficult to reconcile?
There can be a risk, but I think that the EU framework will have an influence worldwide. I think it will be the first piece of legislation on AI. So as was the case with the GDPR, I think it will also set the scene for others to follow. Whether, of course, you use the same concepts or not, that's another discussion. But of course, considering that the EU is such an important global player, I think it will set the scene when it comes to trustworthy, which we discussed in a previous cast, but also like on the legal consequences. So, of course, it will set the scene, but this does not prevent others from adopting other or similar rules. But it will set the scene, I think.
So you expect that the risk-based framework will be adopted not just in Europe, but other places as well, but that maybe specific rulings or specific sector-specific legislation will be different then, or how should I understand it?
Well, of course, I will also disclaim because sector-specific legislation may already go a bit farther. But you have this general framework on AI devices, AI products, what is allowed, what do we not want, what systems do we see as risks, where do we impose additional requirements. But I do also think that it goes hand in hand with sectorial legislation, and that already exists. You have regulations on medical devices. Well, of course, they need to interact with this global AI EU framework. And it's also acknowledged in the AI Act that there is some interaction with existing frameworks. And I think this is the way to go because, of course, you may have a general framework, but very specific requirements for a specific sector. So I think you have to look at them not separately, but hand in hand somehow.
I agree. We did an exercise with the Knowledge Center where we tried to answer two basic questions. The first one was, am I making a forbidden AI application according to the AI Act as it was 2 months ago? And then the other one, am I in the high risk category? And when you go to the high risk category, there's a question where you have to say, is your AI system a safety component? And there, I think we had to copy-paste more than 20 safety regulations referring to different sectors or application areas. So this harmonious thing really exists. And it also makes it really difficult to ask these simple questions like, are you creating a safety component? Well, it really depends. And you have to know these 20 other regulations in order to answer that. But that's one of the drawbacks of creating a new piece of legislation. You have to make sure it's compatible, like software, with all the other software running around.
And also because like AI is still not fully well-defined, I think, in those legislation. It's kind of, the definition of an AI is very vague, and you could fit a lot of things under it or nothing, based on how you interpret that. So I think it's good that we have also these other framework more specific to an industry and not specific to a technology, because it's very difficult to even define that technology.
Yeah, I agree that the definition is quite contested in the AI Act. It's very broad indeed. It refers to software that can achieve certain things by using a specific method. But surprisingly, as far as I follow these debates, the definition does not seem to change a lot in the compromise text of the Council of the European Parliament. They some details, but the idea, the definition will, I think, probably remain the same as being software. So it is indeed very broad.
But to extend to the point Virginie made, because and on the one hand side, trying to link two things I mentioned first, I had two questions. I'm trying to sneak in the second one and then my second one. So so what I meant also with the GDPR analogy is that it takes some time to take effect. So there, my question was going to be, is it and not too slow? Things are moving quite fast. Developments are ongoing. Some of the applications are already actually productized and we are... I do hear you say, Virginie, that it's still early days, but yet there are some impactful applications that have already been put in place. So is legislation still on time? That's my question.
One of the basic principles in electronic contracts, but also digital law, is the principle of functional neutrality, which means that you adopt or try to adopt at least legislation that is not dependent upon a specific technology. You enact legislation that is broad enough to cover technological evolutions And this is what you see has been also acknowledged by different councils, the CAHAI, which is working on human rights and AI, but also in different other institutes, that the principle of technological neutrality is really fundamental when you adopt legislation in a data area, let's say. So I think this is what they aim to do with the AI Act, to not make it dependent upon one specific technology, but one specific type of AI, for example, but to try to make it as broad as possible to indeed cover these technological evolutions. Because indeed, it is going slow. We do not know yet when the AI Act will finally be adopted. Some say by the end of this year, it's unlikely. It will probably be somewhere next year. But there is indeed a risk that it can be outdated already. But by adopting this principle of technological neutrality, which you see in different digital related pieces, you try to remedy this potential issue.
I think legislation is late already, because when you are facing some questions, for example, with all the diffusion model that generate images, you have the question like, which images were used to train those models? Was it like, did they get the consent from the owners of these images? And then can you use this model to generate new images? And then who owns the copyright of those new images? Like the people that provided the image to feed the algorithm, the people that created the algorithm, the people that use the algorithm. It's like super vague, but till now you see like everyone is using those applications. There is no regulation around it, and it's just like, let's try and see what happens.
Yeah, I'm thinking about an example. You have Instagram filters. I hope everyone knows them. This can be designed by people, but you already have rules there saying if you create a new image with them, you have no copyright to the person who created the filter, right? And I think if you replace Instagram filter by an AI that assists, then you have part of the answer. It's really about the licensing there. And I think we can actually do a lot with the licensing IP that we have now. And there are some fringes, I agree. But sometimes you just have to look at the form and say, AI is not that new. Actually, it's doing something we have been doing for a long time, like, for example, Instagram filters. And we have already working functions there that everyone agrees on or that can be legislated. There might be some new ones where it becomes more difficult, like the one you were perhaps referring with consent of images to the Clearview case in the US, where images were used without consent. I hope it's a no-brainer for everyone who's working with data based on personal on people that you need a legal ground for processing, as stated by the GDPR, for example. And that's another example where you can see that legislation is actually not too late. It might be badly explained in concepts when you look at AI, but that's like Jan was saying, you need this technology agnostic view. You don't want to say this law was written for that specific technology. It's the same with the GDPR. A lot of people think it's written to stop Facebook and Google from invading our internal markets. It didn't stop them. By the way, but I don't think it's too late. It might be a bit more complicated. And I think you're right. You should ask and demand our policymakers and legislators to clarify the parts that are not right. And I like the AI Act for that, because they're trying to they're trying that with a more agile approach towards regulation with legal sandboxing. They're trying to create this spaces where things that don't make entirely sense in terms of the legal, that don't make sense with regards to regulation, and they're asking regulators to step in and really help the people who are the companies or organizations that are experimenting in these, let's say, murky waters where things are not clear enough, to come up with an explanation of how the law should be implemented there, or how different competing regulations need to be combined and prioritized there. So I think, yeah, we're working on that, but we should keep on demanding more.
And also the AI Act relies a lot on standardization. So the legal framework is set, the general principles is included are included in the AI Act, but then it's up to standardization bodies to adopt the necessary standards to concrete, to make it everything concrete. Of course, you can have some critique on the standardization process as well, because it's lack of democratic involvement, for example. But in say, the more general requirements will become more clear and tangible by including experts at the field companies, standard setting bodies, NGOs, and so on. So this is also an important mechanism within the AI Act.
But so that means, because I hear indeed two things. There's the fact that it's actually a lot of the legislation already exists. It's making sure that you piece together the different parts of the puzzle that are already out there. But there I still can't help but have a feeling that it's quite localized. And if you have multinational companies, isn't it going to be very difficult to consider all of those local standards and things that are applied as a developer building something centrally for that company?
Well, standards will, of course, not be national. In fact, there are national standards, but now European standardization set organizations are on board. So they will develop these standards have this EU approach. Also, you should also take into account that a lot of things like IP and GDPR is already European. Also, contract law remains very important because in this contractual supply chain, it is up to parties to set contract, freedom of contract, to determine what would be in the contract, what is not in the contract. So I think a lot is there already, but what I do think is that it becomes the moment a legal company lawyer, for example, or another juriste would work with AI, you need to have a very broad knowledge of it. This is what we've seen as well with the work at the Knowledge Center, that someone involved in AI as a legal scholar needs to have not only the legal requirements, but also the ethical, which we discussed, needs to have the specific mindset, understanding the technology, the societal impact. So you actually, in times where a specific knowledge is valued, actually, when it comes to AI, it seems that having a broad understanding of how the AI would impact the legal frameworks and where you need to find information is actually also very important. So I think solutions will be there, and especially the contract framework is important as well.
Maybe we can build an AI that kind of scans all of those. No, just kidding.
They're doing that really, really a lot of, I think the GBA, our former privacy commission, actually did an experiment already using AI to bring you quicker to the text you're looking for and the advice you need, because they have so much advices already. So these things are really in the pipeline.
So glad to hear.
I can come back on what you said, that it's important that you are very generalist or that you know a lot of things like legal, ethics, and also the mathematics maybe. And we see a lot of models that are open sourced or a model as a service, and you don't know how they were trained. So who will be responsible then, and who will be legally responsible in these cases?
There is, I cannot answer the question straight away, because there are, it will also depend upon what has been contractually agreed, for example, a contract which is not always available. There may be multiple parties that you can claim, for example. And open source is one example, but take the most common example is the self-driving vehicle. There's mostly not one person that you can target if something goes wrong. You have multiple actors involved. Service providers, but also data suppliers. You got the manufacturer of the product itself. So there's not a single answer. It's often a very complex scenario, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm thinking about Cambridge Analytica to give an example that has very little to do with AI, unless you consider that. It's all about data there. And there the question is, who are the different responsible parties? And you will see time and time again that in these cases, someone will use a risk-based approach and say, did you cover all your bases, or were you kind of not paying attention to all the data that developers were going to promise to Mark Zuckerberg that they will never store on a local drive, which it was really a Boy Scout promise at the time. He didn't cover his ass, I think. He really said, if everyone can swear that they will never misuse my data and I will not put any technological countermeasures in place to check this, then he didn't really cover all the risks, because he could have envisioned that someone might one day make a copy for other purposes. So I think the word is de facto responsibilities in these things. If you look at your entire value chain, were there agreements? I agree with open source. If you don't mention how you trained your model, this is a responsibility of the one who developed the model. But if I simply take your model without reading it and then I reapply it in a very different and dangerous case, then I hope I have some responsibility as well. So there you can really see, when you use risk-based approaches, did they consider all the responsibilities that they should have considered in the first place? And did they then apply good technical, legal, and organizational measures? That's part of the GDPR text. And I think we need to change that.
And AI actually also relying on the risk management approach. So you see similar patterns.
Mm-hmm. And that helps a lot in the discussion, because then you could say, well, okay, while AI is something new, we're still going to do the same thing we always did. And that's have a big discussion on the blame game and who gets what blame in case something goes wrong.
Yeah, we segued into the accountability indeed. So I think somehow it's inevitable to go down that street. I think indeed, at the end of the day, a lot of the important part is who's responsible, and especially of course in the prominent, visible, mediated cases, that's pretty clear. But also on smaller cases within an organization, accountability is important. So who should be the person that should follow up on that? I really liked what you mentioned, where you said, yeah, indeed, when you copy an open source model, if you either don't read the documentation, or there's no documentation and you still copy it without knowing that you don't know, then you have part responsibility in it, which aligns with your point, Jan, I think, where you say, yeah, that is very complex, because you have a lot of people involved and different components intertwined, making it very complex to assign one responsible. Are we going to be able to assign that responsibility? Is that something that will be, should we then look at, are companies going to be responsible for that, or?
In that regard, I think one should also make a distinction between contract liability and in case you do not have a contract. Of course, if in the development of AI, there are many contracts, and I think there it's already determined who's liable for what amount, exoneration, disclaimers, and so on. But I think the most challenging, and a lot of attention is going to that at the EU level, also in the new AI liability proposals, is in the situations where you don't have a contract. And I think the simple example of, again, a partly self-driving car that hits someone, you do not have a contract with driver. So then it's up to you. Okay, start making your case. I leave aside the insurance, because it will probably not be covered by insurances. But then it's up to you. Start to prove where things may have gone wrong in the AI supply chain. Start to prove that the AI system caused you the damage. So the burden of proof for a weak party, a victim, is huge. And you need access to this information. You need to be an expert somehow. You need to understand how these things work. And this is, I think, the real challenge. When we talk about accountability and liability, you can develop as many regimes as you want. We have already many regimes. But if you cannot enforce it, again, if you cannot prove something, if you cannot prove a fault of someone or causation or your damage, then it's becoming difficult. And this is what you see in all these new proposals, is that they tend to reverse the burden of proof, lower the burden of proof, really to protect to the benefit of the victims. And I think this is an as important part of holder who should be held liable. This is one question, but how can you make sure that the party that should be liable can be held liable? So it's really an important issue that is rightly now deserving a lot of attention, this position of victims when you do not have a contract, for example.
Yeah, because I think in the case of credit scoring and things like that, you're also, as a party in the client, so to say, within a weak position in the sense that that model made an estimation on you. Difficult to say whether that was accurate or not.
Exactly.
And try and build a body of proof case.
Exactly. So you need to prove it. You need to, when you, and I leave aside the contract side, because if you have a contract, as you do, probably if you are entering a car, you accept disclaimers. We all do them. If you've got software updates on your phones, you accept it. But it contains a lot of disclaimers on liability. But in case you do not have that mechanism indeed, start proving your damage. What is the damage you may encounter and start proving it. So the case of credit scoring is also one element. But in all of these cases, you should look at how can you make sure that the frameworks that do exist or that will be adopted are really enforceable. And this was a major critique on the AI Act, for example, that it did not contain rights for users. It did not provide rights for those that were indeed affected, for example, to claim compensation. This was a major problem in the AI Act, the lack of enforcement rights for, as opposed to the GDPR, where there's a lot of subject rights. This was not the case in the AI Act. And this is why I'm very happy. Although I may not be a big fan of horizontal liability regimes, I think the AI Liability Act is a nice way of to complement the AI Act in where we need provisions for victims of AI systems, for example.
So I understand correctly that they will now adapt this to...
I do not know whether the AI Act, to which extent they will probably include users' right to a certain extent, because it's been a major hurdle. But this new AI liability proposal that has been proposed in September 2022 will for sure complement the AI Act and will complement the challenges, the remaining gaps in the AI Act will be complemented because these new liability regimes provide rights for victims, for example, lower the burden of proof. So I really see it as a perfect match to align the AI Act with the lack of users' rights, yes.
And so, because this is maybe the European stance on things, how are these things evolving if you look at the rest of the world? Do we see similar patterns?
Well, considering that law is still very much national, I will not do any... I have no idea how other countries would follow it up. But what you see in the EU is that you have national regimes that do still apply. And I mentioned already the difference between contract law and non-contractual liability. Well, although a lot is harmonized at the EU level, non-contractual liability is still very much national. So this is a reality as well. You have diverging regimes in, for example, Belgium and Germany between the requirement of causation. So you see a lot of differences between countries, which is also a reality that we should take into account. But I assume that in other countries, you will have similar regimes, strict operators liability. So you have certain regimes, product regimes, for example, they may be different. There may be differences, but how it is exactly, I don't know. I know there's a lot of diversity. Yeah.
Now, the reason I asked is because one article I was reading yesterday, they actually said that despite, and indeed there might be a lot of cultural differences, and so ethics might be considered slightly different, that if you look at the different regulations that pop up East Europe and West, for us at least, that surprisingly similar type of rules and regulation turn up despite the differences.
Yeah, of course. If you see, for example, in many countries you have legislation specifically at products that could create risk. How this is tailored to the, I don't know, but in a lot of countries, you do have this kind of liability that if you are an owner, for example, or someone who benefits from risk, from activities that cause risk, that you can also be held liable in case things go wrong. You see this in a lot of countries indeed. So there are similarities, of course.
Yeah, because the foundational building blocks were already covering similar aspects. Yeah. So you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I wanted to add that I think Europe is really stepping up its game to create one unified market, which should make it easier for companies to apply the same rules everywhere. The GDPR really was this harmonization move. It's not only to protect personal data, but also to unify one data market in Europe. The Data Act is another one. So Europe is really trying to make it more easy actually to work as one European market. The word there is the one-stop shop. And there, I think the difference between regulation and directive is really important. Regulation immediately applies to all European member states, while a directive needs some translation work. And you see this before the GDPR, we had a directive And it meant you could go regulation shopping. Like, there is a reason why Facebook and Google and LinkedIn are in Ireland. Well, part was because UK and Ireland had a way more beneficent approach towards privacy at that time. So companies based there could use that regime because it allowed more. And I think that's the great thing about these regulations, that we're trying to stop that, that you cannot go regulation shopping, because that's the word associated with the arbitrariness within European member states.
Bit of a question. So now we see like AI is booming everywhere. It's adopted. Like, if you don't do AI, you kind of like not hype. And like, I wonder if those regulations were a bit like slower that trend, if like companies will be a bit colder to adopt those AI technologies.
That legislation will have an impact on innovation, you mean?
Yeah.
Well, it's often said that whether this is a case, some say it's not a case. In any case, I think that the GDPR has shown that it does indeed provide some hurdles for companies, but it sets also a standard internationally. And now you see that companies are getting towards the compliance, because it's also important. And I also think that with the AI with the AI stuff that's going on, the legal requirements is one thing, but of course, it's also a bit marketing, I'd say, that if you could say that your company complies already with these regimes, it's also creating trust. And by trust, you also increase your position on the market. So I don't think it's per se hampering innovation. I think it could also be the other way around, that you could use the law to show your commitments to certain standards as well. But it is indeed a question that leads to different views.
Maybe to tie into that question, can we expect a wave of enforcement happening as soon as the AI Liability Act will become more in place and real? Is that something that will be going up?
If national enforcement bodies have the necessary resources, I'm quite sure they will. I think enforcing the AI Act will be a bigger challenge than the liability provisions, because it's already happening in practice. And I think, again, even if you have a national, an international EU framework, as was mentioned by Rob, these are directives. You need to transpose them. You still need a lot of leeway, freedom, discretion to national countries on specific concepts. If you include, I will not go into detail, but in all of these pieces, the concepts of reasonableness, duty of care, carefulness, this will have to be interpreted, applied in the national context. So I think there still is a risk of diversity. But is it a good side? Are we going to the right direction with these AI liability directive and provisions? Yes, I think because of this procedural mechanism, reversing the burden of proof, really lowering the burden of proof, this has been an enormous gap, and we get now clarity towards the benefit of victims.
I wanted to add to Virginie's question first, like, is it slowing down new regulation? I think there's always a slowdown for organizations, because they have to adapt to a new way of working, and that takes time. It's change management. We talked about this a bit already. You really need to change the way you do business. Like, at the beginning of a new project, you ask certain GDPR questions now, but this took quite a while. I think the question I get from Jan's explanation is, for example, with this burden of proof, is, are we balancing this burden fairly, comparing really big multinationals to SMEs in Flanders? And there I'm a bit more worried. If you look at the GDPR, and we're going to see whether this is the same with the AI Act, well, the smaller your company, the smaller the costs are to hire someone who is legally proficient, a generalist as well, because they have to understand AI and legislation, and not just one piece of legislation, but quite a few. And there you could say, well, this burden, if we're not careful, is going to weigh really heavy on all the SMEs. And that's a problem, because, for example, a region like Flanders really consists of a lot of SMEs. And there we need to be careful. I think the legal sandboxing is one of the measures in the AI Act to solve this. But the other one is, and Jan already said it, we really need to make sure we have enough funding so that our national regulators can proactively translate all these things in a language that SMEs can easily apply, providing templates, but also clarifications so that this happens more easily, because otherwise we are going to have an effect that you see a little bit with the GDPR. Bigger companies more easily adapt to these new regulations, and then you get an unfair slowing down of these organizations. And that's something we should avoid at all costs.
And also, if I may add, I talked about the reversal of the burden of proof. But of course, in this piece of legislation, there are also some measures to make sure that it's not becoming too much a hurdle for companies as well. So I will not go into details, but for example, a company can already rebut this presumption of causality or fault, for example, can also provide the necessary disclose information and say, yeah, this is enough. Eh? So there are also mitigating measures to really strike that balance. And this is, I think, one of the good things in all of these two new proposals is that the balance has really they try to find a real balance to make sure that what Rob says is not going to happen, that you have make a distinction between smaller SMEs and big players.
And are we done looking mostly to self-regulation or self-regulated application or looking for external regulation and monitoring of what is being put in place?
I can only look at the GDPR to say how they try to solve that problem there. Like, you have some hairy questions, for example, in reusing telco data to measure how many people are moving through your city. That's a good one. And there you had this co-regulation. So I'm not saying it's self-regulation entirely, but it's also not regulation from top to bottom. You had a big discussion on if you have a tile of, 100 by 100 meters, what is the lowest amount of people you can have on this tile without losing privacy? Because you can then guess if someone lives in an area that's not that densely populated, you can actually track their movement patterns. And they found a magical number. I think it's 32 or 34, I'm not sure. But there is this minimum number. And if you go below that threshold, you don't get any data from that tile. And I think that's co-regulation. How did it happen? Cropland and a few others had this problem of, well, where are we going to set this K-anonymity benchmark? And then they also talked to the Privacy Commission back then. They were so-called Privacy Commission, but they kind of said, do you also see that this reasoning would make sense sector-wide for people who try to measure people movements through telco data? So I think that's the way to go forward. The problem is resources. Again, you need a sector that unifies, and you need a legislator that dares to sit at the table and say, well, we're going to stick out our neck as well, because it's not clear in the current regulation what we need to do. And we're going to do an interpretation. And we hope that a European legislator that also looks at local legislators agrees to the same principles. And we need to demand a lot more that our national authorities stick out their neck for small organizations, medium companies as well, and large companies to say, well, we dare to make this interpretation. And that's something we need to demand even more with these new regulations.
But in the AI Act also, a critique has also been that there's too much discretion for AI providers. You know that we have this CE marking, for example, certification. Well, normally you can involve a third-party independent notified body or third-party certifier, which then objectively says, yes, your product or your system complies with certain criteria. It can go on the market. But in the AI Act, a lot of discretion is given to AI providers so that they can do a self-assessment and then provide the CE marking. So this is also being criticized when, no, the default rule should be to include a notified body independent assessment, as is being done for certain categories of medical devices and so on. So if you say, is there some self-regulation? Well, I think certification could also fall under this way of self-regulation. It will be seen how this will change in the future, in the final act, but the critique has been that there's a lot of freedom for discretion for AI providers without involving independent third-party assessments.
It's a challenge, I think, that big companies can misuse again. They have solved the riddle of applying a certain regulation, and they don't want to share how they did it. And that's quite unfair for the other entrants in the market as well. So these are all things we need to be very mindful of.
Is that choice motivated by fear of lacking or lagging behind other regions that have different sets of legislation governing like product certification, etc.? Is that one of the main motivators behind it, or why is that the case?
That there's just so much discretion for providers.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
I don't know, but I think also the AI is very complex. The idea is that you also need, and I did my PhD on certifiers. You also need the required expertise. You also need people that can indeed independently assess whether your AI system complies with certain standards. And as has been the case in other sectors, I talk about credit rating agencies. Well, the credit rating agencies had more knowledge than they had the knowledge. So but providers may have more knowledge than third-party certifiers, for example. So it's also a question of this and also resources. I mean, Rob mentioned as well, it's about having the necessary resources as well. So I think it's a matter of competence in addition maybe to other things you mentioned, but I think it's also a matter of competence.
Maybe final question. There are some talks on, as we have created moral persons for companies in addition to physical people. There are some people, some voices that claim that there's a necessity for a technological person. So basically a moral agent, but with limited rights and liabilities, let's say. What are your thoughts on this? Would it be a good thing?
I have a Jesuit counter question. What is the problem we're going to solve with this new personhood? If it's, for example, to create universal basic income for all the people who would lose jobs thanks to AI, if it ever comes to that, then I would say, yeah, let's investigate that one to tax these people as a new form of resources. But it really depends on what the problems are we need to solve by creating another legal personhood.
And it kind of already happened because in South Africa, an AI owns a patent. So isn't it kind of what you are referring to?
Yeah, and then Sophia receiving citizenship in I think, Saudi Arabia is also an example. So yes, indeed.
I think I have some diverging views on it. We should make a distinction when it comes to legal personality between all the ethical concerns and the legal concerns. Of course, I wrote already about it, that we should consider it, that we should, I'm not saying that we should grant it, but we should consider it. And why is that so? Because if you leave out all the emotional reactions, then you get a whole other story. For example, if you would give legal personality on a functional basis, it could potentially resolve the burden of proof. Because if you could just say, we'll impose liability upon the, let's say, the self-driving vehicle, well, then, of course, the victim does no longer have to prove all the requirement of fault, of causality. Then you could just say, well, we have this system that caused or that is involved in damage. We can held it liable. We can hold it liable. Of course, a lot of new questions would arise. Who pays for it? Because in the end, someone will have to pay for it. But I think the idea from a functional, legal, theoretical perspective, yeah, I think there are some arguments in favor, for sure. And if you look at European Parliament, it has been suggested in 2017 by the European Parliament to give legal personality highly sophisticated robots and AI systems. Okay, everyone afterwards rejected the idea, and I don't think it will come yet, but I think we should look at it from a legal, theoretical perspective, and then you get a whole other debate and the questions, yeah, but you cannot put it in jail. Yes, of course you cannot put a car in jail, but this is not the idea. The idea is that really, depending upon the purpose that you have, that it could there could be some arguments why it can be useful.
Yeah. So I've already heard two very interesting takes on it. So the taxation point of view, that it could they could be taxed, and then that could be used to pay the universal income. And then on the other side, it might simplify the liability side of things by having a designated person.
Many challenges arise and many questions need to be resolved. But the basic idea of legal personality could well be, we grant states legal personality as well. So why would it not be possible to grant it one day to AI systems from a legal, functional perspective?
I don't know if you read the book Homo Sapiens and Homo Deus. And in there, the author, he makes the stance that the new god are the legal person, So is it is the new god the AI people? Are they becoming?
I don't think so. But I'm quite sure that people here on the table may know it better. But we still do not have general AI. So as long as we do not have this, I don't think that AI will. Yeah, I don't think that
will rule the earth.
Yeah, it's. I don't think it will. And granting legal personality as such is not. I do not. It's not a way of having like these killer bots. This is not my aim. The aim is to increase procedural efficiency, for example. You find functional reasons why it can be granted for very specific reasons. So I think there may be some benefits as well. So we have to look at it from an objective way on that topic.
So legal personhood for AI will likely not increase existential risks related to AI.
So far, it has been rejected at almost every level, the idea. So I don't think it will. I don't think it will be a risk. No.
We can see if we can hire one, and they have employeeship at least. No, thank you very much for a very interesting session. Thank you very much for attending, for being here, for contributing. And I very much look forward to the next episode.